This podcast may contain content that is not suitable for listeners under the age of 18. If you are 17 or younger and wish to educate yourself about sex and relationships, you should visit scarleteen.com. That's scarleteen with one T.
Hey, I'm Alicia, your non-monogamous relationship coach. Welcome to the podcast where my friends and I chat about our relationships, enthusiastic non-monogamy, polyamory, swinging, kink, and our lives. You'll get a candid peek into what makes it worth it to live life outside the box. And in case you're still wondering, nope, we're not monogamous. Hello, hello, hello. If you are looking for a guide to help you navigate the pain of being vetoed or a breakup, then this episode is definitely for you. I'm chatting with Kira Gilchrist, and she's a relationship anarchist and solo polyamory advocate. And today, Kira's sharing with us how she coped with the aftermath of being vetoed from the relationship that she was in when she was last on the show on episode 9. And Kira's describing how being vetoed can be a very traumatic experience and how she coped with it and the tools and skills that she learned working through it. And she describes for us what a difficult experience it can be and how it can take away your autonomy and choices in relationships. Kira's sharing some really deep and powerful experiences and emotions that she has moved through and how she's moved through them. And I hope that you find this helpful and useful. And I found it really fascinating and just a really lovely share. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe, like it, give us a review, share it with your friends. Anything you do would be wonderful, and I appreciate you. And if you would like more behind-the-scenes content, early releases of the episodes, go check out our Patreon, patreon.com/notmonogamous. Enjoy. Now I've got it. Yeah, so you were on episode 9 in August of 2021. And I think that that is either my second most listened to episode or like the top listened to episode.
That's so crazy to me. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. So I'm excited to have you on again and talk to you some more because people like you.
Oh yeah. Thanks.
I mean,
guys.
I like you too.
Yeah, that's nice. That you're not just like hosting people, but you're right. You're like, so when is this podcast over?
No, I don't air those ones.
Okay, got you. Cutthroat.
That's fun. Yeah. So over a year ago, You were on the show, and a lot has changed since then.
A lot has changed.
I mean, in your life, I mean, a lot has changed in the world, but a lot has changed in your life. And I'm excited to talk to you and hear about how you've navigated all of the things.
Yeah. all of the healing things. Mm-hmm. So a little over a year ago, I got vetoed out of a relationship that I was in for just a little bit over a year. And for those of you that don't know what a veto is, it's when your partner tells you that you have to end a relationship with someone else that you're seeing. Some people will refer to it as like couples privilege, hierarchy, polyamory. And that definitely fits it. Couples privilege is just inherent in some certain dynamics. Like when you're married, there's certain privileges and benefits that you have versus when you're just dating someone or you're single. So and there's a lot of it comes from the things that we believe makes monogamy special and so great, like the assumption that monogamy guarantees that you'll always have a partner by your side for events. You have someone to split finances with. monogamy sometimes, I think, gives people a sense of security that their relationship won't end. And that's that's not necessarily true.
I mean, they all end eventually.
Yes. but it's why, you know, you hear people shocked at, like, why our divorce rate is so high, because the Western standard is that, you know, Western society loves to preach that, you know, it was love at first sight and then happily ever after. And that's not necessarily true for everyone or for honestly the majority of people. So, I got a good taste of a veto for the first time, a little over a year ago. And I will say it was pretty painful. I think I would rank it pretty high on the trauma scale. Some of the things that made it particularly difficult for me was that I was already in therapy rectifying, like, certain kinds of rejection and abandonment trauma that happened way prior to this. But for those of you that have had trauma happen before, you know that even if you've been working on trauma, if something reminds you of it or is kind of similar to things that you've experienced before, it kind of just reopens that wound all over again. And you definitely have a foundation to work with if you've already been in therapy and you've already been doing the work and working on it. So I wouldn't say that it's a free for all, but it can take you right back to some moments that, for me, it really felt like I was walking on the sidewalk and then fell into a black hole. Like, it is probably, like, the best way to describe it. And it took me right back to just those original woundings and pains, and the overwhelming depth of the emotions I experienced was really hard. It was really difficult. I wanted to talk about how I navigated that over the last year. It's been a little bit more than a year now, because when I had my experience of being vetoed, I took my time to look for resources to help me navigate it. And I know that everyone's experience isn't exactly the same, but just kind of an idea of where to start with the process. And I found a couple of blogs, but nothing really substantial. And I asked
a lot, right?
Yeah. I asked in local polyamory groups, you know, what do you guys have? What are you guys looking at when you're dealing with this particular issue? And for those of you that are in, like, online social media polyamory groups, you hear about vetoes a lot. But there weren't a lot of resources helping you to navigate healing through one. So I am sharing what I did, hoping that it kind of gives people a point of reference and maybe just a starting point, hopefully some hope, and to encourage you to have some grace with yourself, because that journey is very long and very hard, but it is possible to walk. So that's what I wanted to share today.
Yeah. I mean, any breakup is hard, but because of some factor outside of your relationship, I feel like even harder. And the other thing I've noticed with vetoes is a lot of times people don't think that that's what it is. Right. Like, they think, I'm choosing this relationship over that one because, you know, for whatever factors.
Yes.
But that's really what it is.
I did this thing that I do with a lot of things when I decided that I was going to jump into relationship anarchy and that it fit me really well and solo polyamory. And I joined all these groups and I read all these blogs and I read these books and things like that. And I was kind of under the impression that people would acknowledge if they were vetoing you. I was also under the impression that people would realize that that was what they were doing. And my experience did not quite mirror that. I'm pretty sure that to this day, the people that I was involved with would not say that I was vetoed. I think, like, for those of us that really want to remove, like, couples privilege from polyamory and have no hierarchy in our polyamory, I think sometimes it can be very difficult for us to admit that it's just inherent in some of the structures. Mm-hmm. And instead of pretending like it doesn't exist, which causes harm to the people who are subjected to it. You know, we really have to learn how to be able to identify it and then mitigate it where we can, but also just own it when it happens. Yep. And so I had made an assumption that if, you know, if I were ever vetoed, like the person vetoing me would be very clear, like, I'm vetoing you. And what happened was kind of this really messy, like, well, it wasn't really because, you know, all these justifications. And I learned, which I'd learned in life before, that healing comes from within yourself. And that just because someone can't admit to what they've done does not mean that you can't be a credible witness to your own experience, which I believe I mentioned in my last episode. You know, you experience the things you experience, you own the things that happen to you and that happen to your body. And if you are going to die by someone else not validating your experience, then it is going to be very difficult for you to kind of grab the wheel and start that healing process. So it became, for me, one of my first steps of healing was just saying that regardless of whatever people were not willing to admit, I trusted myself and I trusted the reality that I experienced. And I was going to move forward honoring and acknowledging the pain that I experienced. And that in itself is a pretty big first step. Yeah. So I really struggled with that. I think, especially when you're sitting across from someone that you really trusted for a long time and that you love deeply. And, you know, you're sitting there thinking like, why are you hurting me like this? Like, you know, it's, I really trusted you. And they can't even own like what they're doing in that moment. And one of the things I really learned also is that usually meta problems are a hinge problem, right? Like, yeah. Technically, I was vetoed by my partner, right? Because they're the ones that carried it out. And wrestling with that and coming to that realization that this person that you really trusted, because there's a lot of vulnerability in polyamory. You know, if you're going to engage with it, you are letting go of a lot of ideas that you got used to in monogamy. And any relationship requires trust. But there is a particular type of vulnerability if you are going to be dating someone and they're a hinge to someone else, you know, like particularly to someone that's married, that they're married to, or a nesting partner, an anchor partner.
Part of that trust is like trusting that they can, that they have enough self-awareness to manage their emotions around all of their partners and around all of their partners' desires and fears and insecurities, and that they can like hold themselves steady through all the different people.
We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Alicia here. You know, the voice you've been tuning into episode after episode. Today, I'm popping in with an invitation that's really close to my heart. Behind the scenes, I've been crafting something special just for you, my dedicated listeners. If there's a voice inside you that's seeking guidance on navigating the realms of relationships and non-monogamy, wanting to like boost your confidence and find that unwavering sense of security, or you're struggling to manage the tricky waters of jealousy, I'm here to offer my support. I've cleared my schedule to open up 50 slots this month for free one-on-one clarity chats directly with me. So this is your opportunity to dive deep into those pressing questions and come out on the other side with newfound clarity and direction. The availability on this is super limited and these spots are going to fill up really fast. So don't miss your chance to connect with me. Head over to my website, aliciapayne.com, right now. Go secure your spot, because together we can uncover a path to a more joyful, fulfilling, and easy non-monogamous journey. Talk to you soon.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's a very intimate, scary place to be in sometimes. And I think that from my experience, I learned, you know, moving on from it, I've learned what kind of hinges I'm looking to date. Like, I have a better idea of the kind of person that would be great at navigating that space and would help me create our relationship to be a secure, safe home. So it's, yeah, it's been a little bit of a learning journey. So when I got vetoed, like I mentioned before, it felt like I fell into a pretty deep hole. Felt like the rug got pulled right from underneath my feet. I will admit that I was pretty distraught, and I was pretty distraught for a long time. I think a few things that contributed to that was, I'm huge about prioritizing my autonomy, and it was just completely taken away from me in that moment. On something that was really important to me, something that I held very dear to myself. I really did love this person, and now they're just gone. Like, they're super important. I'm involved with them. You know, I have the option to talk to them and see them, and all of a sudden I just don't. And that was not something that I elected to do. That was a decision that was made outside of my relationship, and I had to experience the consequences of that decision that was made, whether I wanted them or not. Being a relationship anarchist and thinking that I was engaging with people who also adhered to those principles of respecting autonomy and things like that. And you kind of come to the realization that, you know, everyone has their own pieces of trauma. I really look back at my situation, and I feel like it's just three traumatized people kind of like interacting with each other and rubbing against each other's trauma. And, you know, I did the best that I could to use the tools I learned in therapy to navigate that. I can't say that I always did it perfectly. But when I did my rupture and repair episode, it was about learning how to manage and navigate the rupture that had happened in the particular situation that eventually led to me being vetoed. So I will say that I was trying. And that leads into, like, you know, polyamory is a quote unquote team sport, and relationships in general are a team sport, but there's more teammates in polyamory. And coming to the realization that, like, you can do everything you possibly can, and you can even do it well and do it great. And sometimes it just doesn't come down to you. If you don't have the other people involved in your relationship doing the exact same thing, there's nothing you can do. Like, you can't force people to stay with you. You can't force people to honor you. You can't force people to process things the way that you do. And to an extent, that really is the beauty of polyamory, right? Because you know that when your partner is with you, it's because they're choosing you every single day. They wake up and they're with you. I think a lot of monogamous people struggle to understand that, right? That the only thing holding you together in a relationship is that person chooses you. And for me, the pain of not feeling chosen in that moment where someone else is picked over me and I don't feel chosen, I really struggled with not taking what that action, what happened in that moment being vetoed, and not internalizing it as my self-worth and how much I mattered. And that was really hard. I went to a pretty dark place. I want to say the first 2 weeks for me were the worst. I knew from previous pain and trauma that the best thing you can possibly do is to sit with your emotions and just let them happen and experience them. You obviously
Which is so hard.
It is so much harder than it sounds, right? Just sit with your emotions. I really had to sit with these really overwhelming, intense feelings. And I've been journaling, and I wrote down the things I was feeling when all of this was happening. And I don't know, it's kind of sad going back and reading, like, just some of my thoughts back then. So one of the things that I did do was I made sure to just write my thoughts down a lot. And beyond the first 2 weeks, I did make sure that I was constantly writing down the things that I was thinking, because for me as a person, I'm a very external processor. And I have found that if I do not find a way to release thoughts or ideas, they will fester and they will grow into, they may go to places that they never really needed to go to, that can end up being very harmful for me. So to protect and honor my own mental space and my own mental capacity, I wrote things down. And a lot of the things that I wrote down, especially in the beginning, were not very pretty. Like they were pretty negative just about myself. I really struggled with just, If someone that says they love me could do this to me, then what does that say about my value as a person? And I really struggled there. Some of the emotions that I wrote down that I was feeling at the time, denial was the first one on the list. Mm-hmm. It happened so fast. I didn't have a precursor. From my perspective, there was an incident that had happened in my relationship that involved my meta. And then things were getting better and confident enough that I didn't really have concerns about it. And about 4.5 months later, all of a sudden, it is revealed to me that I've been vetoed the entire time and that now this it's hitting the breaking point. And, for me, it came out of nowhere at the time. And I was really blindsided. I didn't actually know for that period of time that I was being vetoed. I knew that there was a really strained relationship between my meta and I, but I did not know to the extent of where it had really gone. And I didn't really get to know until there wasn't any time left to do anything about it, which I think kind of added to my grief that I would say when I grieve, I'm a person, I like to use my hands. I like to work through things. And I didn't have the opportunity to work on anything before. It was just kind of a decision that was made on my behalf. Yeah. And it was very abrupt. So the denial actually took longer to wear off than I expected it to. And I think it was just, I don't know, it happened so quickly. I just couldn't even... this person's in your life and you love them and you're close to them one day. And then the next day they're just gone. Like there is no contact. There is no, like, I don't get to hear the sound of their voice anymore. I don't get to see them anymore. It's a lot to take in a very quick, like, I'm coming over and breaking up with you and this is why kind of like conversation. So the denial took months, I would say, mm-hmm. for me to finally come to terms with, like, they're not coming back. It was the, like, oh, they'll change their mind. They'll come back. Yeah, exactly. And it took a while for that to sink in. Anger was another one. And mm-hmm. I will say that my anger definitely showed up in little bits and pieces. And I think sometimes I did sound angry, like talking about this with my therapist, but I had a lot of moments where my friends and my therapist would say things to me like, I feel like we're angrier than you are. I think for me, initially I just had a lot of sadness. Is probably just like, I had a lot of sadness. I really missed the person that I lost. I'm gonna try not to cry. Guilt. I had a lot of guilt and regret. I think so for me, I would not say from my perspective, because I can't speak for other people, but from my perspective, my meta relationship was always kind of on eggshells. I think the guilt and the regret for me mostly came from, I knew that in order to keep that relationship for the length of time that I did, I was always dialing down my assertiveness in the presence of my meta. I was in some ways just kind of a doormat, like comments would be made towards me and I never challenged them, and that was intentionally done on my end because there was always this impression that I had that if I did say something and my meta became upset about it, then a choice would have to be made between me or her. And I was pretty sure that I was not going to be able to outlast just a relationship that someone had had for over a decade, right? It's kind of an unfair, unfair to pit the two of those together. And I wanted, you know, I wanted the relationship that I had, and I was actively compromising myself. And I wasn't having my own back, and I wasn't standing up for myself, regardless of what it would have meant that I lost. And it took me a long time to finally acknowledge that I must have not lost much then. if I was harming myself to keep something, and keeping that thing required me to harm myself, then I really didn't have much to begin with. And I actually think, Alicia, that was something that you started a conversation with me because I called you. Alicia does one-on-one coaching sessions, and I did my first one with her kind of when this initial incident happened. And I mean, you know, I could barely talk when I first called you. Yeah. Because I was so upset. And we kind of just spent a moment to regulate and breathe together. And you had said to me, you know, you're asking me all these questions, and we kind of get to the end of it. And you're like, and I can't remember exactly what you said, but the gist was like, if they aren't willing to honor you, then do you really have a relationship? Was kind of the mic drop at the end. Spending so much time with someone that you love, it's hard. It's so hard to acknowledge those like truths, because they're good for you to acknowledge, but it costs you something. Like, it costs you a certain amount of grieving and lamenting to accept those things. And it was challenging for me, because I think having that session with you was the beginning of me acknowledging that I wanted this to be healthy, but this might not be healthy. And I was also still in a place.
Yourself?
Yeah. I was still in a place where I still wanted to try, right? I wasn't really ready to give up quite yet. Learned from that. So that's where my guilt and my regret went from, that I, you know, it was kind of like I was a doormat to someone repeatedly. And then it's like, what did I get from it? You know, nothing. You know, I compromised myself, and there was
so many lessons.
Yeah, so many lessons. Resentment was a pretty heavy one. Blindsided, which I mentioned earlier. Shock, which both of those really went into the denial. I still loved the person that had vetoed me. And it was one of the things that I tried to be really careful with, because I'd seen other people talk about this. It is really easy to, I think, get really angry at the meta who vetoed you. And I think sometimes people, I think sometimes people forget, like, there's a lot of accountability to be had by the person you were dating. And, you know, they were always the protective mechanism standing in between you and your meta. And if they choose not to assume that role, then, like, it's, you know, there was a certain amount of my partner leaving me vulnerable in that space, and not being able to acknowledge just the privilege that was at play, that really the playing field's unfair. Like, it's stacked against me. I'm the new person coming in, even though I've been there for a year. The relationship that I'm quote unquote pitted against is just decades longer than mine. So it wasn't fair. It wasn't fair. It was hard. Sadness, grief, lamenting, longing. I really missed the person that I had lost. You know, I missed them a lot. And I will say that these emotions were really, really intense when everything first comes down, these emotions come up, and they're really intense. They were very overwhelming. I did sit with them. I was very intentional about that, but it was very hard because along with the emotions, the memories come pouring back in. And I had to get really good at giving my brain space to just remember and to process and to make sense of, like, how did we get here? So, you know, for me, I look at it as your brain has to process through things and catch up, and then your heart has to process through things and catch up. And for me, it took a really big physical toll on my body, as well. So, the first 2 weeks I cried so much that for 2 weeks straight, my face was like in constant pain because I was crying so much, my muscles and my face. It turns out you actually have a ton of muscles in your face. And they were so sore from me just constantly crying. I made a decision to let the tears come. I cried as much as I could in appropriate spaces. I let the tears come. And sometimes my brain would randomly remember things. I would get these intrusive memories of just things that I missed about my partner, or good times, or the hard ones was like just when things started going south, and wishing I could go back and redo the choices that I made in those moments. And I let my brain remember those things. My personal tendency when those memories come up, they're painful. So my personal tendency is to want to stop them. And I had learned from overcoming trauma before that you really just have to let them flow. You have to really let the emotions and the memories be like a river, right? They come to you, they flow through you, and then they leave. But if you stop them, they have nowhere to go. So that means
they're just going to keep sticking around.
Exactly. They're festering somewhere. And I had kind of paid the consequence of stopping things up and letting them fester before. And I knew from experience that it's so much harder to work through things when you let them hide and fester up. So yeah. I made a point, wherever I was, when those thoughts would come, to just let the memory happen. And then in my mind, as that memory was passing by, I would say goodbye to it, take a moment and honor it. Because even though the ending is really painful, you were in the relationship for a reason. And I think it does a lot of good to have some sense of balance to remember, you can honor those good moments that happened and that the joy that you got from them in the moment. Kind of let them move on and make space for other memories and other good things to come down the road. So I did that. I sat with my emotions and they were so overwhelming for the first couple of weeks that I will say that sometimes I would come home from work. I wouldn't even turn on the lights in my apartment. I would take melatonin. I would go to sleep because I was so tired of sitting with these overwhelming emotions. So you can always
physically draining.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's exhausting. You can always do short-term coping mechanisms. Now, you can't stay on melatonin forever, it's always okay to have short-term coping mechanisms that are kind of just to get you through the moment. And they're kind of your lifesaver at that point, because at least for me, for something like this, it was really all-consuming just for my emotional and my mental capacity for a while. It took a long time before my brain wasn't constantly fixating on this one thing that had happened and how do we make sense of this? So the first thing was honestly just sitting with my emotions and feeling them learning how to hold this tension where, when things end with a partner, oftentimes it gives us the space to begin to reconcile with the ways that your partner failed you while you were dating, things that maybe you were working on or things that you had kind of chosen to take as a compromise, right? This is probably going to be one thing in my relationship that's not going to fix itself. But when that person's gone, and especially in a veto, you have the opportunity, you get the space to kind of sit there and go back and think through all these things that weren't quite perfect. And you have to reconcile with the way that your partner was human and had flaws. And the tension in that is not allowing yourself to spiral to phrases that aren't true. They never loved me, things like that. While also holding the truth at the same time that the actions that they showed me were not loving, right? Weren't loving towards me, weren't honoring. But their actions sometimes aren't blanket statements, one-way blanket statements. And that was really
it doesn't change the whole history of the relationship.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I'm going to tell you that, like, that was really difficult for me to acknowledge in the beginning. I didn't really want to acknowledge that. In the beginning, I wanted to scream and cry. And you know, I would have people that would say things like, you'll learn from this. And I cannot tell you how upsetting and maddening it was to have people say things like that to me, because I don't want to learn anything. I just want people to treat me right. That's the space that I was in. I was like, there, for me, it's kind of like a senseless kind of pain, like from my perspective, because I'm shouldering the grief and the lamenting. And that's not to say that, you know, technically that my partner probably had to grieve and lament, and that may have looked a lot different for them. After my veto, I found a couple of blogs that talked about being vetoed, and, you know, it was, you know, and some of those blogs, they mention something that also drove me a little batty, that things will get better after you date the next person. And I know the face you're making. We both know this. Yeah, and for me, I actually had no desire to date anyone, after that veto. I actually swung in the other direction and went a little extreme. And I had told a friend, like, I'm not dating anyone ever again. Like, I'm done. I had gone to a place where I had experienced relationships where I didn't feel chosen. And for me, this was like the epitome of that. Right. From my perspective, I'd spent an entire year pouring myself into a relationship and compromising myself for a relationship. And at the end, I wasn't even chosen. And I felt like I'd given so much. And I could not, in my pain, see things being better for me. So hearing someone say, well, this will all fix itself once you date the next person and they're fantastic and they're great and then you can move on. You know, for me, it, you know, being in a space where I was like, well, I don't want to date. And also, human beings are not objects. Right. It was one of the things that I struggled with after my veto, was I felt like an object. I felt like I had been discarded, like someone used me as a toy and then they were done. And then they tossed me out because it was no longer convenient to work through the emotions that came with managing being a Hinge or managing being in a polyamorous relationship. It was like, as long as I was convenient, it was okay for me to be around. But the second things required a more effort. It was kind of like, oh, you know, and that may not necessarily be true from the person that vetoed me. Like, they may not feel like that was where their action stemmed from. I did have to kind of sit with the fact that their behavior was not a reflection on me. It was not a reflection of my worth. And it took me a long time, though. It took me a very long time to really internalize that. There was a point where I was kind of going back and forth, and I wasn't going to use someone else as my coping mechanism. I wasn't going to date another person. So I was, and I didn't
like,
have any other
like your
partners.
Source of validation and your source of self-worth rather
yes.
than finding it inherently.
Yes. Yeah, I really did. I chose to go probably the harder route, and just like, I knew that like all of this stuff had to come from within me, right? Like I mentioned before, like your healing really comes from within you, regardless of whether or not people validate like what happened. It really comes from within you. So I sat by myself, and I felt the rage and the depression and the sadness and the grief, the lamenting, the longing, the love that I still had for that person. And I sat with the memories, and I kind of made my way through them, and they were super overwhelming and hard. And I wrote down every thought that I had, because, you know, I needed my thoughts to go somewhere. I was in therapy. I stayed in therapy, and I had already been in therapy, but all of my sessions suddenly start becoming about this one particular incident. And it was really helpful. I will say it was really helpful to have someone that knew me for years and that had already walked me through navigating abandonment and rejection. Mm-hmm. And for them to understand the context of what made this so extra tender for my heart, and to have someone listen to me talk about my pain. And my therapist has done a fantastic job with that. Nothing was more satisfying than several months later, when my therapist had pointed out to me, she's like, when you come to your sessions, your face is a little brighter now. You know, it was nice to have someone that could reflect back to me the progress that I was making, because I would say in the beginning, I was in such a dark place. It was very difficult for me to see I knew I was making steps to come out, but it was very difficult for me to see that it was successful and that it was working. So to have someone kind of guide me through it, so that way I didn't feel like I was completely alone. Someone that was willing to be next to me doing that labor with me. It was really helpful to have that. Someone to ask me questions and to listen to my grief and pain, which brings me to one of my big tenets of healing from my veto was healing within community. And this idea for me started a long time ago when I was actually deconstructing. I was raised Christian and I had to deconstruct that at a certain point. And that is where I kind of had this realization that, you know, you don't have to wait for this one monogamous love that you're isolated to as far as emotional and mental intimacy and physical intimacy. You can have a community of support and loving people that you already have, just friends. Like, your friends are so valuable. And I would say for me as a relationship anarchist, in some ways, my friendships are more important than my romantic relationships, because they are really a network of support. And one of the things that I've learned before is that when you open yourself up publicly to talk about your grief, it also opens you up to receive support like back. So I made a point to be very vulnerable with people. I talked very publicly about like being vetoed and how I was feeling. I made sure to give content warnings to people. You know, I want to be respectful that not everyone wants to sit in that dark space with me. Sometimes you just don't have the capacity to do that for people, and that's okay, because everyone's dealing with their own stuff. And for the friends that I had that supported me and just had loving things to say to me, it was a great reminder that I am loved, because I think mm-hmm. being in a veto, it's easy to walk away from that and say, like, I'm not a lovable person. I'm not chosen. But then to open up publicly about my pain and have my friends look at me and say, well, we choose you every single day. Like, we love you. We care for you. And having friends that tended to my emotional wounds in such a loving way, having that support, I think really for me was a big point of success. And I had, you know, different levels of support from different people. I did have kind of a core set of friends that, for me being an external processor, were really helpful to have, because they were willing to listen to me talk and process and digest for months on end. They were open to just listening, and they did a fantastic job at not forcing me to quote unquote learn from my experience right off the bat. They did a fantastic job at not dismissing my pain. They really sat with me in this dark place, and they held a lot of labor and a lot of space for me. And I would say that I think it would have been impossible to do what I did isolated by myself. I really leaned on having a therapist. I really, really leaned on having a friendship support network that, people cared for me. And that was one of the things I made a point to do. I started getting intentional with spending my time with friends that I knew cared for me and I knew chose me all the time. And the more that I spent time around people that were investing the same kind of energy and effort into caring for me, the more it helped me internalize this idea that I am lovable and I am chosen, and that that person's actions has nothing to do with my self-worth. It says something maybe about their character or their bandwidth or whatever it is, or their capacity, but it doesn't say anything about me, the choices that they've made, right? And it helped me acknowledge that I was actually okay with a lot of the choices that I made other than compromising myself. But I think that a lot of the steps that I took, I have no regrets in the way that I loved that person. And the things that I did to honor them while I was in a relationship with them. And it gave me the place to feel proud of some of the work that I did do that in that relationship that was actually really helpful for me healing from other things that, you know, had nothing to do with that. It gave me the ability to practice asking for my needs and feeling a little bit more bold about saying like what's on my mind and what I need from my relationships.
So important.
It is, relationships don't function without you being able to vocalize those kinds of things. I think one of the like traps of monogamy is in Western society, we have a tendency to feel like your partner should just be able to read your mind and just know whatever you want and know exactly how to make you feel loved. And that's not true. It's, you know, we're all human beings and we all have our own biases and our own perspectives, and we receive love in different ways that people do. We give love in different ways. We hear apologies different than the person next to us, right? There's so many variances. You have to be able to be open about what do you want? What do you need? And one of the things that I can say about that relationship that I lost was that I got to practice that all the time. I got to constantly practice like, well, this is what I need in this moment. And just learning how those needs felt within my body was a big one, because I think sometimes our emotions and our body gives us indicators like, hey, we're a little low on this and we need some extra of this. But learning how to listen to those feelings in my body and then turn it into a verbal request took a little bit of practice, but I got to do it a lot. So, that was something I was thankful for that relationship. It took me, again, months to get to a place where I could have some sense of gratitude for those kinds of things, because everything else was so overwhelming. But I saw it as a marker of me making progress. It was one of those things that it was like, all of the overwhelming emotions you've been sitting with and all of the memories that you have been like letting speak to you and then honoring it and saying goodbye, it's working. You know, for a long time, it just felt I was taking these steps and I was sitting with these hard things, and it's like, I don't see anything getting better.
What's the point?
Exactly.
It sounds an awful lot like a grieving process.
Yeah. I remember maybe 3-4 months in, I go to my therapist and I'm like, so how long does this take? I'm still like in some ways kind of distraught, and I still have intrusive memories, and like my feelings sometimes still feel really big. And, you know, my therapist was like, it takes as long as it takes. Like there's no time limit on grief. And so sitting with the grief for a long, long time, I would say that, I've gotten to a little bit over a year of grieving. And I would say that within the last maybe 2 months or so has probably been the first time that, like, you know, people will ask me, how are you doing right now? And I'm like, I'm actually pretty good. I'm great. I feel good. My mind does not obsess on this one incident that happened a year ago, like it did previously. And I will say that I feel like I did do such a great job with just listening to my feelings and letting them be heard. And now it doesn't feel like they're constantly screaming at me, like, hear me, like, validate me. I would say, like, the intensity, and sometimes it almost felt like obsessiveness in those emotions. I mean, a lot of that is pretty gone, if I'm honest with you. I would say, and it might be a little bit longer than 2-3 months. I would say probably around August, I started just feeling better. Like, it was easier for me to breathe and say, like, we've let that go. Because for several months, I didn't want to move on from that person, because it was kind of like, if I move on, I lose them, right? Like, I don't have anything other than memories right now. So it was like its own grief to even like say, like, it's healthy for me to move on from this, but I don't really want to, because once I do, there's a finality to that of like that door's closed. And it took a lot of work and it was just repeating the same things that I had been doing. But I would say that I've gotten to a place where I'm actually okay with that relationship being gone now. And I'm okay with admitting that it wasn't the healthiest relationship that I could have been in. I'm okay with admitting that there were good parts to it. Like there was a reason why I dated that person and that I loved them and that love grew. And I'm okay with, at this point, I'm okay with moving on and, you know, saying like, I may never see or talk to this person again, but I remember, you know, what happened, the good stuff, the stuff that wasn't so great. I've taken from that relationship the things that I've needed to learn. Once I had the capacity to learn from, you know, from my mistakes, I did. I sat with those things and I learned from them. And I'm okay with what I have now. Like it has been a long time coming, but I'm okay with what I have left from that. And I'm okay with like closing the door on that completely. So, it was just it took a long time, way longer than I think I anticipated. Yeah.
But what a wonderful thing for people to hear though, that like there's hope and there's, yeah. It shifts and it changes and you come out the other side. And when it feels like it's never going to end, it actually does start to end.
Yeah. I think like I've rolled my eyes at it when like the veto was really fresh. But yes, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You kind of just really, you just have to take one step. If you just take one step and then later you take another step and then eventually you take another one and then eventually you take another one. And sometimes there's not a time limit on when you take those steps or how big they are. They can be really tiny steps in the beginning. They don't have to be massive. Don't require more of yourself. Like don't give so much of yourself that it doesn't lead to conducive healing. So for instance, if you are a physical pain trauma victim and you land in the ICU, no one is coming up to you and handing you a textbook about your wounds and telling you to learn like your wounds, anything like that. You know, they give you space to actually physically heal, right? We stop the bleeding. Like we put you on medicine, pain medicine, like we begin to manage symptoms and you can get to the root of it later. What's important right now is triage, right? We want to stop the bleeding. We want to close up the hole. I think that, you know, people don't realize like you should take care of those traumatic events. Like you should take care of them like a gunshot wound, right? Like you really need to like give them the space to heal, the time to heal, and you can learn from it later. There's no pressure to do that right off the bat. I mentioned earlier, I grieve with my hands. So I just knowing myself from previous grieving instances, I know that I grieve really well when I have something to do with my hands. So, I did take like a box and I made a memory box of just all of the memories that I had of this person, pictures. And I wrote down things that I remembered about our relationship that I didn't want to forget. I bought little like trinkets that symbolized certain things from our relationship. And I put it in there. And, you know, I wrote quotes on it on the outside of the box, just things that this person had said to me that meant a lot at the time. And so it was, for me, it was kind of like having a funeral, like just being able to honor my grief and to do something about it in that moment, because you'll learn really quickly in a veto that you actually can't control everything that happens to you. So, focusing on what you can control, which is your response to the veto and the grief. I really had to hone in on that because it was really easy for me to get distracted with, well, these people did me wrong. And, you know, and it was easy for my brain to want to get obsessive about like, how can we fix that? And the reality is I can't fix what happened to me, but I can heal. Like I can own that healing and I can own that grief. And I can validate myself and I can listen to my emotions and I can remember things. And one of those things for me was taking a box and making a memory box and honoring the things that felt good about that relationship. And every so often, you know, when I would have a really hard moment and I would miss this person, I would go through the box and I would just remember things and give space to honor it. where I knew that things were getting better was probably the summer when I would start to open up the box, and it would make me really angry that this person treated me this way. Wow. You know, because like before that, I had such love for them, and I was so sad and I was so hurt, and, you know, I wanted them to come back. And I hadn't quite fully internalized just the way that that person didn't hold me with respect and with honor. And the more that I processed and the more that I sat with things, the more that that became apparent, the more my brain was ready to just accept that reality. And it got to a point where I would open the box and, you know, the thoughts that would come to my mind was like, this relationship was not enough for me. Like, this relationship wasn't good for me. And I'm not saying that out of a malicious place. I'm saying that in a very like, okay, it's time that we like acknowledge that this wasn't the healthiest situation that we could have been in. It felt okay for me to close the lid on the box and then really not to open it again. Like, I didn't really need to open the box and go through it again while simultaneously saying, yeah, it was good. And I honor that in some ways, but also like, we're learning now, like when we meet future partners, we don't want to make the same mistakes.
What a beautiful way to create closure for yourself when these other people aren't available for that.
Yeah. Yeah. that became kind of a big point. You do, at least in my situation, you do kind of have to create your own closure. It would have been nice if there was accountability and people would own the things that they had said and that they had done. And the way that it just had impacted me so deeply. And I had to create that for myself because sometimes people really don't have the emotional capacity to do the things that you want them and need them to do. And it got to a point where it was kind of like, well, I'm not stalling my own emotional health, like waiting for someone to do something that they may never, like, the reality is they may never have the emotional capacity to do what I need them to do in that moment. So, and I actually remember that being a big point of anger for me. I was so angry that they had given me all this work. I have to heal through all of this stuff. And it wasn't even like my fault, you know? At least I looked at it that way. I will say that that phrase, saying that it's not my fault, that's a little nuanced because in hindsight, there are times that I should have released that relationship before that veto happened. Like times that I had to compromise myself and be a doormat and be the scapegoat. And, you know, the person that I was engaged with really firmly believed that I was the person that was keeping their marriage healthy or unhealthy. And it's, yeah. And we know, right. That's not actually my responsibility. that's on the people that are in that relationship. But when you get into polyamory, it really can shine a pretty big light on things that may not be super great. And some dynamics that you have, it can expose cracks and it can expose like emotions that you don't know how to process, like jealousy. It shines a big light on things that need to kind of be repaired. And I can imagine that it's really easy. Just like I had to process denial from my veto. I think, you know, if I'm in a monogamous marriage, or not a monogamous marriage, but just a marriage, and I think it can be really easy sometimes to fall back on these ideas that come from monogamy, and then the quote unquote last person in becomes the default scapegoat, right? We're not ready to admit that these problems come from us. So, you know, you're kind of the easy person to blame.
Everything was fine before we met you, and we didn't have to deal with another human and their emotions and our emotions about them. We didn't have to deal with that. So clearly it's your fault.
Yeah, that was there. I think like being able to honor myself and saying that, like, I know what I experience. I know I know the reality of it, and I have to create the closure for myself. And then honoring the anger that came with that, right? Like I really was. It really bothered me that they kind of, for me at the time, it felt like they came into my life, just like trashed my inner room and then just whisked off. And nothing infuriated me more than the thought that like they had broke me in such an intimate way, but they had each other, like leaving from that. Like they did that together and then they left together. And it felt like a particular kind of just like maliciousness in that pain, which I don't think that they were awake at night, like, we're going to mess up this person's inner, you know, inner life, and their emotional well-being. I don't think that it was calculated. I think that they were preserving themselves. Right.
Yeah.
And the anger for me came from like, well, you should be able to acknowledge that. Like, you should be able to see that in preserving yourself, you're trampling on me. And, I, you know, have been able to resolve that anger, and coming from it, like, I would say humans are very funny. Humans, like, really, if there's one thing that I think humans have as a primal instinct, it's to protect themselves, right? And I think that there's enough tools available to those of us that are participating in relationships that aren't even necessarily non-monogamous, but, you know, in any relationship structure, I think there's a lot of tools available for us to learn how to not use self-preservation at the cost of someone else's emotional well-being or someone else's physical well-being. And if you're going to engage in non-monogamy, you definitely are going, like, if you're going to be a Hinge, you have to learn, and you have to learn how to navigate that. Find your sense of safety within yourself and honor it. And learn how to like just process the hard emotions. It's, you know, So I've got my memory box. I don't need it as much anymore, like as a coping mechanism. There was a moment where when I first made it, it sat on my kitchen counter where I could see it every day. And another marker of progress for me was when I told my therapist that I felt actually good about taking it and putting it on a shelf somewhere. And I didn't need to see it all the time. And now I don't, it's been a very long, it's been months since I've had to go pick up the box and kind of look through it. And I have gotten better at accepting the reality of the relationship as it was. And
Have you decided to start dating again?
I
know that's what everyone
wants
to know.
Yeah. I have, it took me a long time. It took me a while. Some of that was me trying to protect myself, right? Like I just didn't want to end up in the same situation again. When I did realize like, okay, like, you know, I did the whole, I'm going to be a nun and just a non-monogamous nun. And we're going to a nunnery and we're shunning romantic relationships forever. When I realized that wasn't going to work forever. I made a very intentional move that I did not want to make the next person I date to pay for the things that had happened to me. And there's this thing that sometimes you'll hear people say that you have to be completely healed before going into another relationship. I don't know a single person that is 100% healed before going into another relationship. But I felt like I had resolved enough within myself that the temptation to use that person as my form of vengeance was not like an alluring temptation. Like, it was just not something I wanted to do. Me dating again was about me being in a relationship that I wanted to be in that was healthy and life-giving. And so I actually have found that with someone. I will say that I'm really thankful for the work I did, honestly, before getting into that relationship. I think it's helped me focus on building the foundation to that relationship instead of trying to fix what happened to me in the past. And so I feel the forward momentum with that dynamic. And I did ask better questions this time. I was interested in this person. The person that I had been vetoed from dating, I took a long time getting to know them, for like a very long time. I would say about a year, maybe even more than that, before we had dated. But the difference is that this time I had better questions to ask, and I understood things that I needed to look for and things I needed to hear. The last relationship that I had had where I'd been vetoed, it was important for me to hear that, you know, they didn't veto people and that there was no couples privilege. So I was looking for someone that would say, like, we don't do hierarchy. We don't have couples privilege. And what I learned was it's actually far more valuable to me that if I'm dating someone that has other partnerships, that they say, well, the couples privilege is inherent in our relationship structure. Here's where it is. Here's how I identify it. Here's how I've handled it in the past. Here's how I set boundaries with my nesting partners. Here's, you know, it's, I'm looking for different answers. And instead of saying that it just doesn't exist, right? It's kind of like a white person saying, like, what? I have no white privilege. Like, it's more of just being able to identify, well, I do. This is what it looks like. And I feel like people who are willing to admit that they have that privilege are more susceptible, or not susceptible, but they're just more willing to listen when you say, hey, I'm throwing up a flag here. Like, right. This hurts. Like, the things that you're saying and the things that you're doing hurts. And I think that they're more likely to believe you, you know, because.
Yeah. And be willing to work with you.
Exactly. Like, them acknowledging that the privilege is there isn't going to destroy the idea they had about themselves and their relationship to begin with, and how ethical and morally sound it was. It doesn't disrupt their internal reality and how they view themselves. And I think one of the big challenges was, you know, when I did start raising up flags, like, oh, this is starting to sound a little racist, or this is starting to sound a lot like couples privilege before I'd gotten vetoed. It was, you know, I think for those people that I was engaged with, they had an idea of how they treat people, and it was difficult for them to hear that me saying the opposite of what they had wanted to hear. And I was really fighting with this idea of, like, well, it's not possible because, you know, I was told, like, well, this wasn't done because you're half Black, or, you know, like, things like right. that. It's all of a sudden the excuses come out because your brain is really good at shielding you from right. facing things like that. Because it's painful to sit there and say, like, I'm hurting someone that I care about, you know? Yeah. And so this relationship I have now, it's newer. I don't have a lot of history to, you know, to talk about, but I will say that I feel like the foundation that I've built with this person is solid and better than what I knew to build before. And so, I feel like my skills at navigating those relationships have gotten better. And I'm not going to lie, I kind of hate saying it because, well, I mean, initially when I was vetoed, I really hated hearing about people finding relationships after they'd been vetoed. But I will say that this is a relationship that has brought a lot of peace, I think, to just my inner being. And I'm really happy about just, I think this person and I are on the same page as far as, like, setting boundaries and, and honoring each other and respecting each other. And that has brought me a lot of joy. So
good.
It's been
makes me so happy.
Yeah, thank you.
You deserve you, so yeah. much joy.
Thank you for participating with that in me.
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly taken some of your advice, like just the things that you share and stuff. You shared a post months ago about, oh, now I can't remember it, of course, when I want to bring it up. But it was, you had a post a long time ago that was really impactful for me. And I'm pretty sure it had something to do with jealousy. And I know what it was. You had said, you know, that there was a moment for you where you realized that, like, no one is you, like, no one can replicate you. And so, like, you know, your partner choosing you, you know, no one can replace you because there's no one like you. And I will say that post in particular has helped me a lot, even, like, actually just moving on from my veto and just being, like, going from a place where I didn't feel chosen and then kind of looking at the idea of, like, well, this is what chosen and healthy looks like. So that way I know what to look for in the future, and choosing myself, right? Like, just,
yes. which
which sounds nice, like to put, you know, on, like to sew into stuff. And
right. Yeah. It's a good nice. Bumper
it's
sticker.
It's actually really hard. It can be very hard. I know that I'll leave off with a couple more points. I know I'm technically hitting my time limit. Okay. I remember I woke, so maybe like 5 months after I'd been vetoed, I woke up in a cold sweat from a bad dream. And I have this image in my head of, you know, I felt like this person that had vetoed me had like discarded me. And I was still battling this idea that like it said something about my value as a person. And I woke up from this dream and I was processing it and journaling it. And I had this image kind of come to my mind of like a black trash can with black trash in it. And then on the top was a piece of gold. And the idea that I had from that and processing was that he didn't throw away trash. So I might feel discarded. And I do feel like I was just kind of tossed to the side, mm-hmm. but he didn't throw away trash. So it was like my inherent self-worth and just the fact that I have humanity, that my value is worth like more than gold, right? It is, I'm still valuable, like regardless of how people treat me. What I took away from that was that for me, justice was healing the wound that was done to me on the inside. And that was something that I really had to own. And even though it didn't feel right in my body at the time, all the time, I kind of had to just drive the point home that I have worth and I am chosen. And my emotions didn't always feel that way, but I had to kind of actively tell, like, correct my thinking. Like I had
your brain.
Yes. I had to like actively, like when I had thoughts come up of like, you know, like I'm not worthy and I'm not lovable, or I'm not good enough. I had to remind myself like, no, he didn't throw away trash. Like you were never trash to begin with. And the way someone treats you does not alter your self-worth. Or your value. And the justice here is evening out those scales, bringing the healing back into yourself. So that way you can function from a place that's not of like vengeance or pain or, you know, and I had my moments where I really, you know, I really wanted to get these people back and I chose not to. It was a very intentional choice on my end not to. And I decided to kind of let them go, quote unquote, in peace. I mean, I didn't really have an option technically. You know, if I wanted to be a nuisance, I could have. But focusing on myself and restoring the justice within myself, it was really, honestly, was probably the most valuable thing I did, healing from that veto and walking away from it. So, yeah.
Beautiful. Oh. That makes me so happy because I did. I've got to watch your process a bit. And,
you did.
And yeah. it's so hard. It's so heartbreaking. And I love seeing you on the other side with your face lit up.
Yeah. You know, and I have to be honest with you, I was not sure I was going to get here. So there's been a lot of joy for me. I would say like recently I've had a lot of people point out like, you seem better. You seem better. And I do, I genuinely, like, it's not coming from a like forced place. I genuinely feel better. I feel more regulated. I trust myself a lot more, because being vetoed made me feel like, oh, I should have caught that. And, you know, how come I didn't prevent this from happening to me? And, walking through the grieving process helped restore that trust within my own body and being able to trust my own reality and things a lot more. And so it's really, really validating for me to have people say like, it's nice to see your face, you know, you just look better, because it was really fucking hard. It's a lot of hard work. There were a lot of sleepless nights. I cried so much. This was not easy. And I hate the idea of people thinking like, you know, polyamorous relationships don't cost you something, or, you know, they're just flings or whatever. It's no, like you are deeply entwined with the people that you engage with, and there is a lament when you lose them. So yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. Yeah. And there's so many, God, you just dropped so many like pieces of wisdom and like information that people can take with them.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be another one of those very highly listened to episodes.
You know, my hope is honestly that like, if it just helps literally one person, that's like, I've just been vetoed. Like, what do I even, where do I go from here? Like, what do I even do? Honestly, it's worth it because I feel like there is some kind of responsibility for those of us that have healed through things to kind of like shine lights in dark places. So, so yeah, my hope for it is that it's a light in a dark place and it gives people some sense of like, okay, this is kind of how I can begin to process. It'll be different for every person, but just some sense of a roadmap is kind of nice. And the hope that like the grieving does come to an end. It doesn't feel like it initially, but eventually if you listen to it, you sit with it, you let it be heard, it does run out eventually. So
yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You get to the other end of it. Someone, I don't remember who it was. Someone said that emotions are like a tunnel that you're crawling through, right? Yeah. And you have to go through them to get to the other side.
Yeah. They emotions do not do very well being locked up and put away on a shelf, right? They are meant to be experienced and processed in healthy ways, but to be experienced and to be processed. And I really think when you're dealing with things like sadness and anger and grief, like they just want to be heard. They want to be validated the same way that you want closure. Those emotions want closure. They want to be acknowledged and believed. Like they want to be believed that you're angry for a reason, you're hurt for a reason. And you know, for me, it's helped viewing them as people, like, and giving them a humanity in my mind and like visualizing myself sitting down with them and just listening, like, what do you have to say? For me, it's helped a lot. So.
Good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for hosting me.
Of course. Anytime.
Thank you, Kira Gilchrist, for being on the show again. If you want to hear her, the other episode that she was on, it was episode 9 of Nope, We're Not Monogamous. Have a great day. Bye. Thank you so much for listening today. It would mean the world to me personally and would help us keep this little podcast going if you would subscribe, leave a review, or share this episode with your friends. For more personalized support with your own relationships, we can work together on a one-to-one basis. Just visit my website at aliciapayne.com and schedule a free call to chat about life, the universe, and your relationships. Bye.